Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, why empathy is the secret sauce of science. And perhaps the conundrum that Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg is a good illustration of this. Zuckerberg is an unquestionably brilliant computer scientist, and when he has to, he says all the right stuff about privacy. But has this latest incident revealed that Zuckerberg doesn't truly understand this breach of trust at an emotional level? Can he really empathize with the intrusion and exposure that many Facebook users feel? Now, this really isn't a roundtable about Facebook, but I thought it might illustrate some of what we're talking about today. It's a wider discussion about empathy and science, and as our conversation begins, I'd like to hear from you. If you're working or studying in the scientific field, does empathy feel like a necessary part of your work? How do you think it shapes your perspective as a scientist? You can tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Today, our roundtablers. Relyn Hardtke is a physics professor at UW-River Falls. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Devavani Chatterjee is an associate professor of biology at McAllister College. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Doug Dunstan is a clinical faculty member with the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Carrie.
Doug, I guess I have to fess up that this roundtable began when you invited me over to one of your classes to talk about listening, and the conversation went into empathy. And this is something you've been talking to students about for a semester, right?
That's right. We had a small course of engineering students, and we invited engineering students who wanted to see what would happen if they tried practicing empathy. What would happen, and could they learn how to be better listeners? We didn't really even know if the students would come, but then we opened it up, and a group of brave engineering students who they actually came in and they said, "We're kind of scared about being here. This is not what we normally do." And then they just jumped in.
Devavani, does that make sense? That would-be scientists would feel a little nervous about delving into this area of empathy and emotionality?
You know, the very fact that we're even having this conversation, right, I think points to a perception that floats around and is so pervasive, so persistent, that somehow science is a mode of inquiry that is removed from the foundational connection between human beings, which is one of the expressions of empathy. Mm-hmm. Science is a human endeavor. It is done together with other humans, and it plays out in society, in local and global societies, where people are putting their heads and hearts and hands together to solve problems. So my bias is to think that we come in with empathy, that those students who show up in my classroom come in as entire human beings ready to put themselves to work. And so I think if they're scared, I hope it's only for a second before they realize that the work they're doing is about human connections.
Oh, I love that description. I have goosebumps. I love it. But I do have a lot of physics and engineering students who say, I'm in physics and engineering because I don't want to work with people. I don't want to talk with people. And I have to break it to them all the time. You can be a genius, but if all that genius stays in your head and you can't communicate it and you can't share it and you can't explain it, it's not going to do anybody any good. And so I do see students who need to practice those empathy skills. And one of the things I find exciting is that the research shows that we can teach people empathy. It's not something you're born with or born without. Right, yeah. And that makes me really excited.
Yeah, that was one of the really surprising things we found. We surveyed the students as we were wrapping up this course and were completely blown away by their responses. They said, not only did they say that they had maybe underestimated what all is involved in science and engineering, that it they didn't realize that all these skills could fit in. But the amazing thing was they said that they were possible. It was possible to learn these skills. They found themselves getting better at it.
You know, I kind of wonder if some of this is a misunderstanding also of what bringing empathy means into the quest for knowledge in the scientific field or any other field. Relin, what do you think?
I agree. I think it's also a misunderstanding about other fields. Like, we like to think of science as objective and standing
right.
on its own and separate from liberal arts. But in fact, you know, math and science is part of the liberal arts. And it can't stand alone without humanities and social science, you know, from theater and art and geography and literature. It doesn't stand apart from those things. And as we make decisions about what gets funded, what doesn't get funded, what gets published, or who's going to benefit from this investment or who's going to be harmed by this investment, it doesn't stand apart. And I sometimes think that we mistakenly think it stands apart. And I think that's where empathy learned in those other fields through liberal arts, but also through the ethics that we teach in our own science and engineering courses, really can make a difference.
I sort of have a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek response to that. If a student comes and tells me, well, you know, I really want to work. I love working with people. And I say, well, you're in luck.
There are people.
You know, you are in luck. I don't know what you're going to do yet, but you are going to do it with people. And, you know, if someone were to say that I don't want to work with people, say, uh-oh, you know, because I don't think we can actually insulate ourselves, you know, that we can actually isolate ourselves, because our work, like all work, touches people. And but I do think that there is a perception, you know, and that you have to kind of stop and think and say, oh.
Well, I think some of this is because our culture tells us that empathy is, and I used this word earlier, emotional, and that is somehow weaker than objectivity. That is a mistake that the culture makes about what empathy is. Doug?
I think empathy of more as an imaginative act. We spend our whole lives from our own individual vantage point, right? So it can be very easy to see other people as either helping us or getting in the way of us.
Yeah.
And in fact, everyone is just out there for us. It is possible to see that. But if we imagine, what would it be like if we interact with the world as if there are actually other people? I mean, how would that change the questions we ask, mm-hmm. and how we
and
how
the
we
reason
behave.
You ask the questions too, right?
Right. And so it causes these questions to come up, but it's imagining. I think of it in that way, as much as an emotional issue, it's an openness to a possibility out there.
I was thinking about this as this idea that we have that the quest for knowledge is the supreme purpose, right? To know. But what we really know is that the quest for knowledge is because gaining that knowledge will touch, you know, the humans around us, will make a difference to the world around us, right? There's nothing sterile about that.
That drives a lot of people. And some people would argue that fundamental research is done in the absence of thinking about how it's going to help people.
Really?
So I've heard people say both. However, I want to point out that by recent history, I mean the last several hundred years, that people have started to separate through philosophy, nature, empathy. You use the word emotional. The feminine, right? And science started to be discussed as something that was the conquering of nature, right? Reserved for the realm of logic being better than emotion, male being better than female, science being better than feelings. And so there's a lot of history there that really goes into our loaded feelings about science as objective.
Yeah,
and that's created by humans, that separation, that and I think that's part of that that we're trying to undo that separateness.
Yeah, yeah. There are lots of lecture halls that still look the way they looked in the 19th century, right? With the pedestal up front,
right.
And then the poor people listening to the expert up front. And that's just not the only way we can interact with each other.
I saw you smiling when I used the Zuckerberg example here. But I want to talk about that for a minute, because there's been some interesting analysis of why the company, and Zuckerberg specifically, cannot seem to take in the depth of what the concern, and in some cases, the betrayal of what has happened here with sharing this information via Yeah, how do you interpret it?
Well, Facebook started as a way to rate the looks of women in college. I mean, how could we expect more?
Was that really what it was?
It was a big part of
mostly
it.
Mostly used for that? Okay. Yeah, Doug, you don't think this question of where is perhaps empathy missing from the reaction of the company, or specifically him, the leader?
I don't know how the profit motives fit in, how the business is designed to work, but actually listening to people, is that built in? If that's not built into how their organization works, you can't just tape it on later.
Right. Devani, do you have a thought on this?
You know, I'm also listening and thinking out loud a little bit here. And I wonder about, you know, this kind of perception of companies like Facebook, you know, if you're working for Facebook, and I don't know what it's like to work for Facebook, you know, how, I mean, do you listen to each other? Is there a sense of community in sort of the process of creating this product, this environment, this social network, right? And then does that sort of extend outward? So if you've built a network, is there a sense of responsibility
mm-hmm.
to yeah. the members of that network? And, you know, I think where I was going in my head with an earlier piece of this was both this notion of, well, how do we teach empathy, but also where do we recognize those connections, and not just in terms of how they pertain to us.
Good point.
But
right.
what do they mean? And you talked about the old style lecture hall. And my mind, you know, kind of went to my research lab and any research lab, but I'm just thinking of mine right now, where you walk in and anything that you do, you're able to do because everyone around you is supporting that work. And I tell my students who take my research methods course and, you know, that you have lots of ideas of how you're going to excel in this class. And I'm going to support you in all of those. But I'm going to tell you one more you may not have thought of yet. And that is, you're going to do better than you think in this class if you care about how well someone else is going to do in this class. And you help them get there. And they come back and they say, you know, that made sense.
See, that kind of turns the idea of the competitive classroom a bit on its head. But wow, that makes so much sense.
I mean, I teach that way too, where if you can lift someone else up, that is a positive. But that is not the way a lot of people experience physics and engineering. I mean, so many people in my generation have the story of the professor walks in the first day and says, look to your left, look to your right. One of the three of you
oh,
or two
goodness.
Of the three of you aren't going to be here at the end.
Yes.
So it's a complete culture change that we're trying to create. I will point out that there are places where bright people are still taught to solve problems. Whatever difficult problem is put in front of them, just solve it. I know that this happened when I was at MIT, you know, really bright people would solve the problems put in front of them, but they were not taught to ask why they were given that problem or how their solution would be used. And, you know, a lot of my colleagues ended up working in the defense industry or for the intelligence agencies or companies related to those. And so I think it's important that we start asking those questions, because I know they can solve problems, but are they asking the right questions? And I think that may be the case in the Cambridge Analytica situation is, yes, we can do it. Should we?
Mm-hmm. Right. And you bringing up the intelligence agencies and the defense industry also, I want to believe that the people that are working in those companies and those agencies are channeling their empathy when they ask the right questions and when, you know, an engineering project is on the table. I want to believe that.
Mm-hmm. I think many of them do.
Yeah.
Those institutions are now not completely independent of our political system, however.
Right.
And so I'm not sure that everyone is asking those questions.
You're listening to a Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about empathy and science, what I'm calling why empathy is the secret sauce of science. Is it, Doug? Is that, you think that's a fair way to describe it?
Well, I think
take
that's,
down my whole approach.
No, I think so, because if we're getting to the question of why we do something or how we do something, to what extent do we use science to tell us how to do science?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really we use our whole selves to determine how we're going to apply these technologies or what questions to ask. So it's not science all the way down. It's science plus the rest of us. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. So that's our conversation right there, where empathy fits in to science. And I'm asking you, as you listen to this discussion develop, if you're working or you're studying in the scientific field, does empathy feel like a necessary part of your work? How does it manifest itself? Tweet me at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Devavani Chatterjee, one of our guests. She's an associate professor of biology at McAllister College. Doug Dunstan with us, clinical faculty member with the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering, and Relyn Hartke, a physics professor at UW River Falls. I don't know if we narrowed down, I don't know if we zeroed in enough on what we mean by empathy when we talk about it in the scientific field. And Doug, I come back to you on this because you're defining this for your students as you're introducing this into the class. So what
yeah,
is
I,
it in
I guess
your view?
I guess I would come back to the listening part, because if you have a group of people together and no one is listening to each other, if it just is a bunch of people talking, that feels completely different
yeah.
than people listening to each other. And we all know from our own experience of trying to listen to someone, and at the same time we're trying to listen, we're coming up with a script in our head of what we want to be saying and not wanting to lose that. There's a little fear that we might lose our own chance to shine here.
Right.
And so we try and hold on to this idea, and we all have the experience of trying to hold on to what we were going to say while listening, and we realize we've missed what the other person is saying completely. But on the other hand, if those times when we're able to drop that fear a little bit and not script what we're going to say, but actually listen to each other and be changed by each other, then something new can come out. I think that's what a conversation is.
So when I went to the class to talk about listening, what I appreciated about where that conversation went was a receptiveness to this active listening, engaged listening, also requires me to test my own ideas. If you're really listening, right, you have to be shaped. You have to be influenced by what someone else is saying, whether they're challenging your ideas or not. You're adding to this idea of what you believe. Maybe you're changing your view somehow. But that is a powerful exercise. Scientists do that enough, do you think, Relyn?
I think some do. And I want to point out, I have to mention Evelyn Fox-Keller, who's one of my heroes, but she was one of the first scientists to talk about how empathy can affect our language and the way we see physical, biological systems. Instead of talking about parts of the body, one controlling the other, or genetics, one piece being in control of the other, she started talking about things in terms of feedback loops and feedback mechanisms. And this really was a revolution. And we still have language. We know that shapes how we think. We want to believe that we shape language, but language shapes how we think. And so we still have loaded language in a lot of science. And so I think when we start bringing in empathy, we can have a language that is clearer, more fair, and may result in better scientific outcomes and better scientific understanding when we're not stuck in the old language choices. And I'm afraid to say, but there's still language choices out there that we don't get rid of because scientists hang on to our history. But like in computer science, you will still have the terms master and slave for components of a computer system. And, you know, I hear about, as a student, people would talk about slaying an equation. I was like, what are we going to slay? oh, do you mean we're going to solve this equation? I do think Evelyn Fox Keller was the beginning of this conversation, and I'm so glad we're still having it because it's still needed.
Yeah, my field is an example of that. Yeah, I'm an immunologist, you know, and if you just ask somebody, what do you think your immune system does, right? It's very likely they'll say, defend us against pathogens, yeah. right? And if you look at little videos that are sometimes made for children, alarmingly, you know, they're very militaristic. There's a little army of T cells. You know, there they go, sort of marching along, you know, and vanquishing the pathogens. And I think that that was a notion of, you know, what the immune system is or does, which has been really challenged and upended just by all the things we have learned. You know, that not just the genome we inherited from our parents, but the microbial genomes that reside, you know, in the ecosystem of our body are critical. This cooperation is critical to keeping us healthy, to even allowing us to exist as these, you know, organism/ecosystem entities. And that the immune system is not about defense. It's about sensing change and perturbation and trying to restore the balance, right? It's homeostatic. But just that shift in language, you know, is something that I have had to consciously do in my classroom. And I didn't necessarily do it because I wanted to teach empathy. I did it because we need to understand the immune system, you know, and we can't use that dated language and dated notion. But I think it does remind students, you know, as we're unpacking this one technical piece of the understanding of life, it's like, oh, it matters. Language matters.
Well,
because
said.
How do we think about it?
And I know Doug has talked about listening to people, but we also listen to our text and we listen to what we read and we listen to the videos and the narration that goes with videos. And that's another piece of critical listening that we need to include as we talk about science and engineering, those narratives that are very loaded.
So, yeah, so as far as a loaded word, I mean, would you say that science is a conversation or is it an argument?
Good question. Devavani, what would you say?
You know, I would say it is a conversation. It can be a heated conversation sometimes. It can be a supportive, generative conversation at other times. Is a conversation because these problems are just not things that we solve by ourselves. You know, we have this kind of sense of truth or finding the explanation or the thing. But what, as practicing scientists, we know that that is provisional. It's the best model. It's the best explanation we've come to right now. And we remain open, which is at the heart of science. We remain open to what will change us.
Open.
Right?
So I don't know if it's fair to ask this, but so Carrie, why do you call them conversations with Carrie Miller and not arguments with Carrie Miller?
Right. Yeah. Because I love to argue.
To you, what's the difference?
That would be fine. You know, I was just, as you asked that, Doug, I was thinking, I think argument gets a bad rap too, because I think argument suggests an exchange of views in a culture in which we're not really listening to the other person's views. I think argument can be very empathetic, but what you have to do is enter the argument with a lot of practice of listening, right? So I'm choosing, as Rellen talks about language, I'm specifically choosing to use the conversation because I think that indicates receptivity. But
you find that possible in argument also.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think argument is more dynamic and interesting. I'd like to say every day you're going to hear an argument about some discussion, right?
Yeah. And, you know, and it's I mean, I did just answer that saying I think it's a conversation and I do. But at the same time, I just think when we teach writing to our students, right, and all the disciplines, we say, OK, what is your argument?
Right.
And I have actually switched to a different word for that.
What do you use?
And I use story.
Oh my gosh, that's perfect. That is perfect.
And I use story. Because I say, what is the story that you're going to tell? What is the evidence that you're going to bring to you know, support the story that you're telling?
Right.
But what is the story that you're going to tell?
You know what that signals to me is, what part of yourself are you also going to bring to the story that you're telling? Right. See, that's an indicative to me of, I want to know what this means to you too. Right? To the story.
Yeah, you don't tell a story where nothing changes.
Right.
So you have to be open. And I think that's a little bit of the loading in the word argument that we, as we commonly use it, is that we're going to win.
Yes.
But I think that's
the political culture that we're in has influenced, right. has given the word argument a bad rap. Relen looks a little skeptical here.
Oh, yeah? I was for about 2 seconds. And then when you said, what evidence are you going to bring to your story? I was completely on board. Yeah. And I do want to point out that sometimes I think when we talk about discussion, people, there's a sense that all opinions are equally valid. And it's not true. So we do have to be evidence-based. So as soon as you talked about what evidence are you bringing to your story, I was on board. But I do think we have to talk about evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And rigor. But yeah, arguing, discussing, sharing with an open heart, open mind is great in the presence of evidence.
Doug, do you think your students, when you introduce the idea of argument into a class discussion, they perceive that as... the tenor is going to change. This is a different thing than you know, having an interactive conversation about it.
Well, I have to admit, I don't use the word argument.
You don't? Specifically?
Pretty specifically.
Yeah, and why?
Because I think our students have so much history in a narrow form of argument that they think is make up your mind and then put it out there in a form. I'm thinking of the first year English composition paper, which ostensibly is an exploration of an idea and supporting evidence and contrary evidence. But in practice, what is done in college, for example, what is learned is... I'm going to get in trouble with all sorts of people here.
I've got your back. Go ahead.
is to come up with an idea to express and to express it with sort of a not real countering information. It's all there is no listening in the freshman English paper. It's just a one-directional statement.
I know that many of my colleagues, like if it's in English or geography or gender studies or science, they'll often ask a student's opinion on a particular topic. They'll ask them to think about that, reflect about that, and then they ask them to argue the other side.
Right.
Right. So
and that's
a very effective tool. Right.
It bothers them a lot. It makes them uncomfortable, but I have found it incredibly effective.
So I think this is super valuable. I've been recommending this book, How to Think, to a number of people. I love this book because the author is very open to high quality argument, opposition against what he believes. In fact, he's on he even uses social media in a really smart way. He is part of a Twitter group where it is a collection of people who don't agree on a lot of highly polarized topics at the moment. The only requirement is that you come in with high quality argument. You can't just default to the same old, same old. And he talks about the meaning of that in this book. And as I'm talking to people about fake news and another stuff that's going on in journalism, I'm saying the how to think is part of being very open to the other argument, and letting that test your own depth of belief or your willingness to be receptive to a different argument. And people are pretty afraid to do that these days, just as you've kind of described with the students that have to argue the other side, but to be willing to be changed.
I think what you phrased in there about there are some ground rules in the discussion. You have to bring in high quality
on the social media side of that.
Right?
Yeah.
And also what can make this work is if there's a community that's having the conversation.
That's
so if
right.
there's trust, there has to be this containment vessel or expectations so that people will support each other when they risk putting forward an argument.
There is risk in that. It's a good word. Yeah.
Oh, that's such
there.
A good point. And that's what we try to do when we create our classrooms, to make it safe to share those spaces. And that I just had a light bulb go on, Doug, so I thank you for that, about that, creating that community where it's safe to do that. Like, I think I've been trying to do that and have done that successfully, but I've never thought about it in those words.
Yeah.
And so I just came back from teaching abroad as part of a study abroad program. And in that community where American students are traveling in Europe for a whole semester, they're seeing how humans are alike, right? And I think that's a big part of empathy we may not have touched on yet. But as vastly different as cultures and languages and priorities can be, humans basically have the same fundamental needs and wishes and wants. And so in that sense, it's instilling empathy in every one of those study abroad students. But we also discuss those things that make us very different, and the priorities that America has that are seen as very foreign or odd and strange and hard to understand by other cultures.
That's such a valuable experience at that age, too.
And they did it as a whole semester. They are doing it as a whole semester in a community where it becomes safer and safer and safer for them to have those conversations.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about empathy and science. Devavani Chatterjee is with us from McAllister College. Doug Dunstan with us from the St. Thomas School of Engineering. And Relyn Hardke with us from the UW River Falls. Okay, so Relyn, before we went to the break, you were talking about this experience that the students are having going overseas, having to see how what they take as kind of gospel, right? This is what America is, and this is what we stand for. Their identities, right, in some ways,
yes,
as Americans, are seen from the outside looking in. What did you observe about how the students were processing that?
I think they saw, well, first of all, they saw the infiltration of American culture in the most what you might think of sacred spots, of ancient Europe. You'll find a McDonald's everywhere. But we were in Barcelona for part of the time. And so to learn the history of Spain and that movement, and I mean, they knew very little about the Spanish Civil War and, you know, how that was really, they were unfamiliar with who the sides were in the Spanish Civil War. And in Italy, for example, when we're talking about science and empathy. I was teaching gender issues in science, so we talked a lot about reproductive technologies, and basically all reproductive technologies are illegal right now in Italy.
Wow.
So surrogacy, those kinds of things, egg donation, sperm donation. And so we're in the United States, depending on what state you're in, you know, having that be part of our commercial or capitalistic society is normal almost now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they saw current differences, historical differences. They saw differences in the value of family. I mean, they're shocked that childcare is free in much of Europe. I mean, they just saw entire economies that are operated very differently than ours is. And also one of the reasons I taught in Italy is because almost half of PhD physics Almost half of the PhDs awarded in physics are awarded to women. And so why is that in Italy so different from the United States? And so it's just revelation after revelation. And sometimes you can tell that they need to kind of go in their shell a little bit. Like, you know, my America's okay. You know, how I grew up is okay. I'm not, you know, they feel a little battered. But then they're like, oh, hopefully they see we're just showing them other ways.
Isn't that the true value of not just travel as a tourist, but, you know, true empathetic kind of travel, right? You see how we're seen from the outside looking in, and you you see, right, how people live their lives and mostly want the same things.
Well,
that
in
Americans
addition
do?
To the seeing part, I noticed you said you taught, mm-hmm. right? You didn't just send the students to see these things.
Exactly.
And so there, I think there's a saying, something that going is not knowing, I think they say about study abroad, because there's another component there, and that's this reflective